This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington, and here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It was a political response to an economic problem, and the political response was the wrong medicine. And at the end of the day, it brought even more negative results on the economy than what would have been the case.
That was socio-political analyst Effie Nkubi on the Zimbabwe government's decision to reverse its widely criticized suspension of bank lending. Details coming up. Also, the trial of former South African President Jacob Zuma has been delayed again. All these and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Mali's military junta says it thwarted an attempted coup last week led by army officers and supported by unnamed Western state. Colonel Abdoulaye Maiga, Mali's government spokesperson, read a statement yesterday on state television saying the takeover attempt by what he called a small group of Malian anti-progressive officers and non-commissioned officers occurred the night of May 11th and 12th. He said they acted with the unhealthy intention of breaking the dynamics of the refoundation of Mali. The statement gave few details on what allegedly happened. However, a military source speaking on condition of anonymity spoke of around 10 arrests and said others were underway. Mali has undergone two military coups since August 2020 when the army ousted elected President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita. A nightline curfew is in place in Goma, in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, after the U.S. Embassy warned of a possible terrorist attack. Reporter Zanem Neti Zaid has reaction from Congolese citizens living there.
The warning by the embassy to U.S. citizens has produced alarm for many Congolese living in the city. Justin Bendera is a motorcycle cab driver. He tells me that the security situation remained volatile. He thinks that if the enemy decided to attack Goma today, no one would be able to escape. According to him, the city is not secure, so it is difficult to monitor the enemy. The U.S. Embassy alert indicated that the attack could occur on a boat on the waters of Lake Kivu. Since then, no exceptional measures have been observed at the public port of Goma, laments boat captain François Mugisho.
He says that all activities are continuing at the port as usual. Business and shipping on the lake are continuing normally despite the embassy's warning of a possible attack on the boat. He said he has yet to see any police deployment, let alone the implementation of a checkpoint for people. Civil society is asking residents to remain calm and for the security services to work harder. Marion Gavo is a president of civil society in Goma. He tells me that he is calling on the entire population to remain calm and not to panic, not to touch any device they find. He is also asking the urban and provincial authorities to reinforce security in public places by organizing, for example, controls with metal detectors. After the U.S. diplomatic alerts, the National Police Commander in Goma reassured residents that all units are on alert and that the province is under a state of siege, including military role and nighttime curfews. I'm Zanem Netizaidi in Goma for VOA News.
The government of Zimbabwe today lifted the recently announced suspension on bank lending, which sparked widespread criticism and added even more instability to the battered economy that it was supposed to help. More on the story from Bulawayo.
The ban was introduced last week and immediately caused a domino effect across the economy as producers and retailers hike prices of consumer goods and reject the weak local currency. Economic analysts say the reversal of the bank lending suspension is due to the growing pressure from citizens and businesses alike, already reeling from hyperinflation and an economy that is hurtling downhill. In a statement, Central Bank Governor John Mangudya announced the suspension was being lifted while insisting that investigations continue of companies suspected of involvement in speculative activities. Analysts questioned the logic of a blanket ban in the first instance. Sociopolitical analyst Effie Miller called it heavy-handed and unjustified.
It was a political response to an economic problem, and the political response was the wrong medicine. And at the end of the day, it brought even more negative results on the economy than what would have been the case.
Analysts and critics say the lending ban and other restrictions that the government imposed were worsening the situation. They accused officials of adopting knee-jerk approaches in managing the economy.
Lifting the restrictions is an acceptance of defeat.
The Zimbabwe Banking and Allied Workers Union, ZIBAO, says such policy somersaults hurt the country's image. Peter Mtasa is Secretary General of the group.
There was no logical reason why the government, the president or Reserve Bank pronounced this ban of banking loans in the first place. The ban caused a serious shock in the market that will be felt for many months to come. And also it caused the economic agents to lose trust and confidence in the market and in the authorities and in government. So whilst we appreciate that it has been lifted, we are still disappointed that we have caused a great damage, enormous damage to the economy for no reason.
There are widespread calls for the government to sit down with stakeholders across the divide in a concerted effort to halt the economic freefall. For VOA News, Lawayo, Zimbabwe.
To stay in power, some African leaders opened the door for Russia's authoritarian model. In the Central African Republic, Russian influence to back a non-democratic system was far-reaching because it aimed at the country's rich resources. Support of Russia's proxy leaders were also propped up by Russian disinformation campaigns and election interference, as appeared to be the case in Mali. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa's Center for Strategic Studies, discussed these cases with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shinawi.
Well, Russia has had several objectives in the Central African Republic. I think first, it wanted to displace French influence and therefore enhance Russia's global posture and the perception of influence on the continent. I think second, Russia saw an opportunity to gain control of a sovereign African state in a part of Africa where it historically has not had much influence. And we've seen this in tangible terms in that there's now a Russian as the national security advisor in the Central African Republic. The presidential guard is run by the Wagner mercenary force. And other mercenaries associated with the Wagner group, they haven't been focused so much on stabilizing Central African Republic, but as on maintaining Touadera as the president and therefore ensuring Russian influence, and also to take control of the diamond and gold mines in the north of the country. And this, in turn, has enabled Russia to facilitate an illicit trafficking network connecting some of the gold mines that it is also controlling in Western Sudan with what's going on in Central African Republic and then taking them out through the East Coast. So there is a strong financial incentive to maintain that arrangement.
Support of Russia's proxy leaders in Africa, propped by Russian disinformation campaigns and election interference, was another tactic that was obvious in Mali. What was the African or international community response to such practices that preceded the invasion of Ukraine?
Disinformation campaigns we've seen in Mali started in 2018, 2019, as best as we can tell. You know, this was at least a year prior to the 2020 coup. And, you know, those different disinformation campaigns were, you know, highly negative toward the sitting democratic government, and they helped foment dissent and protest that was used as a pretext for the coup in August of 2020. And we've seen the disinformation continue since with a very strong pro-junta, pro-Russia, anti-France, anti-UN, anti-democracy theme in that disinformation. And this is part of a broader use of disinformation by Russia in Africa. Russia's linked at least 16 known disinformation campaigns targeting the continent, emphasizing these same themes. And so it provides Russia a low-cost tool to shape narratives on the continent. I think so far we've seen very little response by either African or international actors to try and negate the influence of these different disinformation campaigns. Destabilizing activity. This would require more pressure from governments to take down these false post and condemn these campaigns. It would take coordination with some of the major social media firms so that they're more active in monitoring these disinformation campaigns and then taking them down. It would also just take more positive messaging, putting forth truthful fact-check information and defending and putting forth a positive message on, you know, practices of good governance, democracy, transparency.
Can you give some examples of how some African leaders opened the door for Russia's authoritarian model in Africa in order to stay in power?
Russia's been able to gain influence in Africa because Russia is such a permissive environment. And it's permissive because there aren't very strong checks and balances and accountability structures in many countries on the continent. And so a leadership, a government that is authoritarian-leaning, that doesn't want to respect constraints on executive power, one that isn't necessarily popular, you know, it would find support from an external actor like Russia very attractive. So in addition to, you know, the well-known cases of Eastern Libya with Khalifa Haftar or Central African Republic, Faustin Touadera, or in Mali with the junta there, you know, you have cases like Sudan and Madagascar and Zimbabwe, Republic of Congo, South Sudan, Cameroon, and others where I think there's receptivity to working with Russia and adopting some of the, you know, mechanisms of the Russian model in Africa.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. The first Sustainable Energy for All Forum in Africa is underway to discuss ways to close the energy access gap on the continent. The United Nations says clean and affordable energy is the key to achieving sustainable development goals, which in turn helps ease poverty and raise living standards. Eugene Iwimana has followed the forum and has more details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
Over 1,000 government officials and energy experts from around the world are in Kigali to consider what can be done to improve the lives of more than a half billion Africans who still don't have access to electricity. Speaking virtually, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged participants to act now to bridge the energy access gap and ease African poverty.
Closing the energy access gap and ending energy poverty is crucial to delivering on the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development. It is also fundamental to tackling the climate crisis.
The meeting's theme is driving bold actions for a people-centered transition. Damiola Ogimbi, CEO of the forum, said it has been proved that when poor and rural people get access to electricity and smart cooking facilities, their development and lives change at a quick pace.
People must be at the heart of the energy transition. Our energy future must be clean, but it must also be just, inclusive, and equitable. We must bring electricity and clean cooking to billions of people so they can have access to the same economic and social opportunities as those who already have abundant energy supply.
Rwanda's President Paul Kagame said the COVID-19 pandemic has worsened the state of energy poverty in Africa and that sound policies are needed, particularly in rural areas, to foster renewable energy and industrialization.
Expanding the use of off-grid technologies and standalone systems can help bring power to rural communities in Africa more quickly. Second, going forward, we need to integrate industrial policy with a sustainable energy policy. We need to plan now to be able to power Africa's future industries sustainably, but without slowing down our development.
The UN estimates that globally more than 150 people who had been alleviated from poverty have gone back into extreme poverty. Participants in the Energy Forum hope their efforts and actions will raise their lives again because energy creates jobs and opportunities. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Eight African low-carbon enterprises are among 11 organizations from across the world showcasing how clean energy can power up entrepreneurship and inclusive development in the most marginalized communities. The climate innovators on the continent were revealed late Monday at the Global Energy Conference in Kigali, Rwanda. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The organizations shortlisted for the prestigious 2022 International Ashden Awards are from Kenya, Togo, Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Uganda. They include Enagro, a tech startup growing sustainable rural electricity demand in Africa. Aaron Leopold is its chief executive officer.
Enagro really looks at the energy challenge, not from the supply side, but rather from the demand side. And we're actually the only company on the continent that is partnering with energy companies to help grow demand for energy in rural areas. The biggest reason why energy isn't everywhere is because we don't really have a market for it in Africa. If you have a market, you have supply equaling demand.
He says the current cost of supply is hundreds, if not thousands of times more expensive than what people can afford.
What we are trying to do is, through microfinance, offer electrical tools and appliances that help people earn a living. And we also provide small business training for them. This is carpentry equipment for the carpenter using hand tools, a refrigerator for the small shopkeeper, the tailor who's repairing all of your clothes. With all of this work, the energy companies sell more electricity. The customers of ours using the microfinance and these tools earn more money.
About 570 million people in Africa still go without electricity, undermining social and economic development. The International Energy Agency, or IEA, says the number of people without access to electricity in sub-Saharan Africa increased in 2020 for the first time since 2013. Manduli's Energy in Uganda, which is turning agricultural waste into electricity and clean cooking fuels, has also been shortlisted in the Energizing Agriculture category. Alex Thiran is the director of Humanitarian and Sustainability Nexus for Manduli's.
Our focus is really on bringing opportunities to smallholder farmers in Uganda, but also across Africa. And we do that by using biomass energy, purchasing agricultural waste from farmers in order to power communities, but also power agricultural processing at a fraction of the cost. By purchasing the waste of rural smallholder farmers, we allow them to diversify their income.
Thiran says the initiative also helps to improve household livelihood and promote local agricultural processing and milling at a fraction of the cost. She welcomes the spotlight of being shortlisted for an international award.
To get this kind of recognition from the Ashden Awards, which is such a prestigious award, when it comes to climate action, means a lot. You know, not only is it further exposure, but it's validation that what we're doing makes sense at a global scale.
The shortlists for the Ashden Awards, three prizes focused on energizing agriculture, refugee livelihoods, and energy access skills were unveiled late Monday in the Rwandan capital, Kigali. Ashden is a UK-based charity that supports climate and energy innovation in low-income countries. Ashden, along with partners in Africa, are calling for November's COP27 climate talks in Egypt to focus on boosting energy access. Harriet Lamp, Ashden's chief executive, said supercharging economies and raising people's incomes are just two of the many reasons for investing in energy access. The initiatives range from solar-powered hubs where refugees can launch businesses in Uganda to training programs helping women launch clean energy companies and careers in Togo. The 2022 Ashden Award winners will be announced in October. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
South Africa's National Prosecuting Authority, the NPA, says it's confident that three Indian businessmen brothers, the Gupta brothers, who allegedly stole billions of dollars in corrupt deals, will eventually face justice. Darren Taylor reports.
Zuma says state capture is a media creation and that his successor, President Cyril Ramaphosa, orchestrated corruption allegations against him. The Gupta brothers say their activities were legal. They began building a business empire, including interests in mining, media and computers, in South Africa in 1993, forming close relationships with top ANC members. In February, Interpol issued red notices for the Guptas. The International Crime Fighting Agency circulates these for fugitives wanted for prosecution. NPA Deputy Director Anton Duplessis says the notices request law enforcement worldwide to locate and arrest the Guptas so they can be extradited to South Africa.
Of course, extradition is a process which involves many role players, from the police to your executive authorities to your foreign affairs departments. But at the moment, the matters are with Interpol. The arrest warrants and the red notices have been issued. The key issue now is locating where these suspects are.
Investigators have told VOA the Guptas are flitting between Dubai in the United Arab Emirates and various cities in India. The governments of South Africa, India and the UAE have extradition treaties. In theory, says Duplessis, this should make it easier to bring the Guptas to justice in the country of their alleged crimes.
We've done the groundwork, we've engaged with our colleagues in the other countries, and as soon as the red notices are given effect to, we're confident that the extradition process can proceed and can proceed without too much delay. But unfortunately, it is at this stage out of the hands of the National Prosecuting Authority because the matter is currently with Interpol with those red notices.
Duplessis says the Guptas have a lot to answer to, including allegations they bribed cabinet ministers to win fraudulent contracts.
When the extradition request is made, and we hopefully get these suspects back to the country, not only will the case strategies be in place for the prosecutions to begin, but the assets would have been restrained so that we can move ahead with not only bringing to trial and bringing to justice these suspects, but also getting back the money that was allegedly stolen by them and many of their associates.
The Johannesburg Stock Exchange says Atul Gupta alone had holdings of almost $11 billion in South Africa in 2016. Duplessis promises real movement soon with prosecutions of those who allegedly perpetrated some of the biggest ever financial crimes, not only in South Africa, but the world.
We're confident now that over the next 6 months, the plans we've put in place, the collaborations we've developed, and the case strategies that we've designed, that these cases will be enrolled within the next 6 months, as well as the other cases that have already started, that we're going to see a major shift in sentiment in this country, that the idea that impunity is something that's going to continue for these crimes, that is simply going to end. Justice is going to win again in this country. It's just going to take a bit of time.
The Johannesburg Stock Exchange says Atul Gupta alone had holdings of almost $11 billion in South Africa in 2016. Duplessis promises real movement soon with prosecutions of those who allegedly perpetrated some of the biggest ever financial crimes, not only in South Africa, but the world.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.